But I really appreciate, more importantly, what Caitlin's done, both in her career for the ACLU, in the national office, and now here for the ACLU of Montana. And I'm especially thrilled that Caitlin has chosen to come back home. And in so doing, I think she debunks many of the longstanding myths among parochial Easterners like us, that there are, like me, rather, that there are two countries, right? The coasts and then the country in between. And that we often think that there's not enough in common, that there's such difference that you either ride or fly over or deride the middle of the country. And yet by Caitlin's willingness to come back to work where she grew up helps debunk those myths. It helps emphasize our differences. It helps emphasize our similarities rather than our differences. It helps show that we can be united in a search for progress and solutions. It makes clear that good, passionate, committed individuals can be found anywhere and everywhere, and that the prairie and the mountain states in particular have a long history of a strong libertarian streak and a questioning of government power and authority, which I think is quite resonant and quite important in a time when we need to demand more from our government. And third, I also think that because the challenges we face as a country are not that different from place to place. They may have different faces, different manifestations, different causes, but many of the same challenges are the ones we confront, you know, here in Bozeman or in Brooklyn. And if we're not willing to look at where the common challenges and where the common solutions might lie, we might not be as effective. Tonight I wanted to focus my remarks. I wanted to present a proper lecture. It is a university with a very large podium. I feel that when you're done with this, you can ship it to me. I could use it as my casket when I die. But since it is a proper university, I prepared a proper lecture for you. And I wanted to frame my remarks for you tonight to talk a little bit about a concept that's not found in the law books or in statutes. It's not found in the Constitution. But it's the concept of redemption. And I feel that it's a concept that is an explicit component of how we live our lives, both at the legal level and every day as we rub against one another, that it's an essential value of American society, that redemption is a powerful and necessary part of our national fabric because it gives all individuals who have done wrong a meaningful opportunity to do right. And it gives us as a society a chance to benefit from their efforts to be redeemed. And this is not just an abstract concept. This is something that most of us, all of us, I dare say, have lived and experienced in our everyday lives. Which one of us has not understood the importance of those, the power of those words that are just sometimes so difficult to get out? The words, "I'm sorry, I let you down, wish I had done differently." Which one of us has not felt the importance of being able to, "God, I got to clean that up. I have to fix that. I did wrong. I got to do right. I know better." Which one of us has not understood the importance of asking for that moment of forgiveness and redemption when we don't wish to be judged by the very worst act that we have done on the worst day of our life? And so in our core, in our bones, in every way that we have lived, this core value has often inspired us to be better and bigger people in our everyday lives. That very same value needs to be mined in the context as we think through our criminal justice system and our legal system. And a criminal justice system that does not recognize that people can repent and that society can benefit from that redemption is one that fails our public and fails the people swept up in the criminal justice system. According to Joseph Stalin, there's this legend that he said, a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is but a statistic. And here in the United States, the American gulag now contains 2.2 million people behind bars. The United States locks up nearly 700 of every 100,000 of our residents. We are the world's largest jailer, and our incarceration rate is more than one-third higher than the country of Russia. We possess 5% of the world's population, and we detain 25% of the world's prison population. Now, you don't have to know much about recent American history to know that this isn't just some accident. We didn't just end up here by happenstance. It really has been an epidemic of incarceration that has been constructed after decades of conscious policymaking and lawmaking that has led to this human tragedy. And it stems not from the political crimes that Stalin would have defined as his prisoners, but they do descend from domestic American politics. Politics that gave us the war on crime, a cynical attempt to win over white moderate voters who were scared by black activism in the 1960s and 70s, and has since been reinforced by countless local, state, and national laws produced often by cynical legislators of both parties, both Democrats and Republicans, trying to prey on the fear of the public. You've heard the rhetoric. Sometimes it's been dog whistle politics, where it's shrouded in some type of metaphor, where we talk about predatory gangs, or we talk about the inner city crimes. Sometimes it's been more explicit. You've played the Willie Horton card. You've played the card of, you know, three strikes and you're out. Lock them up and throw away the key. You did the crime, you do the time. All these metaphors, all these shorthands that have been part of our public consciousness have been used to reinforce the idea that we should be tough on those who broke the law. The war on crime was soon followed by the war on drugs. You remember that. Nancy Reagan, just say no. Ronald Reagan, often enacting very strict anti-drug laws. And the war on drugs, equally suspect, brought a whole new class of nonviolent offenders into brutal prisons by design. Some would call the war on drugs the new Jim Crow, that purposefully and by design targeted minority and low-income communities for incarceration. On top of that, today you find thousands more are incarcerated simply for the fact of being poor, thanks to a resurgence of debtors' prisons, of individuals who are incapable of paying court-ordered fees or fines, fueled by lucrative government contracts given to for-profit prison corporations that deliver large dividends and investment earnings to shareholders because they have locked up as many people as possible and done so to benefit their profit margins rather than the public. Now, this isn't just an abstract policy or a wonky debate around laws and policies. It's that actually when you have 2.2 million people who've been now incarcerated, it's a tragedy that has real human consequences. And so I thought I would introduce you to a couple of the people I've come across in my travels who help paint the human face of the epidemic of incarceration. The pipeline in to the system. Take the story of Craig Cecil. In 2013, we issued a report called The Living Death, Life Without Parole for Nonviolent Offenders. And we featured the story of Craig Cecil. Craig is a father of two, and he owned a truck repair business that also he rented out trucks on the side for people who had small errands to run, you know, like man with the van, if you will. He would rent out the local trucks. In the spring of 2002, Craig went to retrieve a truck that he had rented out to two individuals who, unbeknownst to him, had used the truck to transport marijuana and then abandoned the truck along a kind of a desolate roadside. When he went to claim his property, the truck, he was arrested and charged with being part of a conspiracy to transport and sell marijuana. Even though he didn't have anything to do with the conspiracy, he had no idea why the fellows had rented the truck from him. He had never bought, sold, or even used marijuana. And yet he found himself caught up and snared in this conspiracy charge. Now, looking at a very long stretch of a criminal conspiracy case with felony charges, of several felony charges that would run consecutively, he was given the very bad advice by his attorney that he should just accept, of a court-appointed attorney, that he should accept the plea bargain, and that the plea would require him to testify against the other conspirators. You know, the real problem was, though, that Craig wasn't part of the conspiracy. He didn't know anything about his so-called co-conspirators. He didn't know the details. He couldn't deliver the goods. And when he tried to withdraw from the plea deal, the judge forbade it. The conspirators who actually did commit the crimes and did willfully try to break our laws, each of them were sentenced to sentences between 5 and 10 years of incarceration. But because Craig followed the advice of his lawyer, and since Craig could not deliver on the plea deal, he was sentenced to life in prison without parole. And because it was a plea deal, Craig Cecil could not appeal that charge. So now he's 14 years later. Craig remains behind bars, where we spoke with him. He speaks weekly with his two daughters, who were 14 and 10 at the time when he was arrested. He never expects to see them again. There's no chance of a second chance unless we change the laws that govern cases like Craig's. He is a very despondent, broken man who says to us, "I hope to die sooner rather than later." That's what he says. Now, it's easy to become a statistic in America, especially if you're black and male. The ACLU conducted an in-depth analysis of marijuana arrests in all 50 states and the District of Columbia for the prior decade. And we found that, among other things, there was a staggering 8 million marijuana arrests, 8 million people arrested for marijuana between 2001 and 2010, 88% of which were for mere possession. Now, even though black and white communities and black and white individuals use marijuana at roughly the same rates, that the research shows that white students at a different university are just as likely to use marijuana as black students at another university, a black person is almost 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person. The racial disparity exists in my own native New York, the state with the highest rate of marijuana arrests in the country. But even here in Montana, when I looked at the data tabs on the research for Montana, where marijuana arrests are less than one half of the national rate, so that is to our credit here in Montana. But a black person in Montana is 3.5 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person, looking at the demographics. And while nationwide analysis tend to highlight the black and white disparity, data from states like Montana and others with a large Native American population draw a similarly large disparity in marijuana possession and arrests for Native Americans compared to whites. Now, what does that mean? It often means, for racial minorities, that their families, their communities, their lives, their jobs are severely disrupted and they're punished for doing something that many white Americans also do but with very little consequence. Take the case of Demarcus Sanders, another one of our clients that I've met over the years. Demarcus Sanders was profiled in that report I cited about marijuana arrests and the racial disparities. Demarcus Sanders was pulled over driving in his local town for playing his music too loud. The music was apparently very loud, and the cop was irritated by the loud music. Pulled him over, and because it was a proper stop, he was able to search the car. Demarcus did not object to the search on the car. And once they searched the car, they found that Demarcus was, in fact, carrying a small amount of marijuana, which led to his immediate arrest. As a result of that marijuana arrest, and started because he had the music too loud and the windows down, Demarcus Sanders lost his janitorial job, which he had held for several years. He was incarcerated, unable to post bail, without the resources to post bail, lost the credit for the college classes he was in the middle of, but unable to attend because he was in jail, and then unable, because his driver's license was revoked, to take his son, who had chronic asthma, to his weekly doctor's appointments. And his son got sicker and sicker and sicker as it got more and more despairing. Now, it's hard to pay your fines if you don't have a job, if you lose your job because of your incarceration. It's hard to find a job when you can't drive to a place. And Demarcus Sanders, living in Cedar Rapids, doesn't have a very good public transit system. And so he was left with very little alternative other than to watch his life and his job, his college classes, his son's health slip away from him merely because of one small marijuana arrest. Now, in our America, you don't even have to commit a crime to end up in jail today. That you have this resurgence of what I thought was utterly unthinkable, that something almost medieval, where we lock people up merely because they're not able to pay their fees or their debts. So, introduce you to one of my most heartbreaking of clients, Edwina Nolan from Escanaba, Michigan. Now, she was working to try to find a way to get out of a temporary homeless shelter where she and her 15-year-old son were living. The problem was that her son got picked up by local police officers, also on a low-level marijuana possession offense. And because he was being prosecuted through the juvenile justice system, he was 15 years old, the local court system in Escanaba required Edwina to pay the amount of money that it cost the state to transact the case of her son through the juvenile justice system. So she was court-ordered to pay $104 of legal financial obligations, a court supervision fee for her son's case. When she couldn't pay that $104 because she was living in a homeless shelter, they threw her into jail for 30 days. She comes out of jail. Right after getting out of jail, she gets a job at a local Wendy's, goes to work for an entire week, picks up her paycheck for $178 for a week's work. Now keep track of the math because it's important. She owed $104 as court-ordered fees, couldn't pay it, got out after 30 days, went to work for a week, got $178. When she went down after cashing her check to the local county clerk's office to pay the $104 and to get that monkey off her back, they said, "Oh no, Ms. Nolan, you owe us the $104. But because we had to take care of your son when you were locked up in jail for 30 days and put him in social services, you owe us an additional $120 room and board for your boy and another $22 for a drug test that we gave your son, which he passed. And so you add up the numbers, $104 from the original fine, $120 for the room and board for her son, $22 for the court-ordered fee, is, what, 248? But her paycheck was only 178. So they threw her back into jail for 30 additional days, which is when someone in the local jail said, "You got to call the ACLU. They'll try to help. You know, this is crazy." Even, you know. So she called us. We were able to win her release on the grounds that she had been sentenced unconstitutionally without an assessment of her ability to pay, and denied her court-appointed attorney. Now, it's hard to imagine a more Kafkaesque situation than the one she confronts, that you're locked up because you're too poor to pay the court-ordered fines. And then when you're not able to pay the fines, and you do the 30 days, and you come back out, and you get a job, and you go first thing to pay the fees, and they tell you of an additional fee, and then they lock you up again, it is Kafkaesque. And it's happening in our very modern-day America, in places like Michigan. And what happens when you get to jail? 2.2 million people. That's over twice the entire population of the state of Montana that's behind bars, right? An entire state, twice over. What is it like in many of these prisons and jails? The LA County Men's Jail has an average daily population of 22,000 prisoners. The largest jail system in the world. It was built for a population one-fourth that size. And since 1985, the ACLU has been suing left and right this LA County Men's Jail for the poor conditions of confinement, for the overcrowding, for the violence, for the lack of health care, for the lack of proper assistance. And as a part of our litigation and a part of a court-ordered consent decree, they have to grant us access to the jail on 24 hours' notice. And so all we have to do is give them 24 hours and say, "We're coming in tomorrow," and they have to give us carte blanche to walk through the LA County Men's Jail to observe the conditions. I've been through the jail now twice in my time at the ACLU. It is the worst jail I've ever been to. I've been to Rikers. I visited the New Orleans Parish Prison Jail after Katrina. I've been to Guantanamo half a dozen times. This is literally the worst jail I've ever seen in progressive blue Los Angeles County. The hypocrisy of it all. The overcrowding is evident. The general dorm, general ward, which are the prisoners that are either supposed to be pre-adjudicated, that means they're innocent until proven guilty, are housed in rooms that hold 250 men per room. The bunks are three bunks high. The guards do not patrol the interior of these rooms. It's much too dangerous for them. They patrol through the perimeter, where there are windows where they get to observe the hell that breaks loose in these general dorms. There's constant attacks, gangs, fights, violence, rapes. You have 250 men in an open auditorium. They're all crowded there. They take every single one of their meals in their dorms. There is no cafeteria, no room for a cafeteria. They take showers twice a week. They're entitled to 2 hours of recreation time, which is on the black tarmatted roof of the jail with high chain link fences. And it is scary to walk into one of these general dorms, as I did. You go from the general dorms where they're wearing dark blue jumpsuits, you go to the sex offender ward. This is where I thought I would be perhaps most troubled. You know, the idea of individuals charged with preying upon kids or sex offenders. And I was utterly struck by the youthful nature of the faces of the defendants in the sex offender ward. They were a lot of very young men who look to be 18, 19, 20 years old, many of them allegedly having relations with underage girls. And so because he's 18 and she's 15, they're charged with statutory rape and put in the sex offender ward. The vast majority of the people I saw there were not what you would typically visualize when you heard sex offender. You saw so many of our young men who were just there. They were wearing white jumpsuits. And because they are labeled as sex offenders, they are often subjected to the greatest of violence, both from the other prisoners and from the guards. The violence being so rampant and so wanton and so indifferent that the ACLU lawyer, whose job it is, which we could never pay her enough to do this job, to monitor this prison twice a week. That's her job, is to go in and take the stories, take the narratives, what happened now, who got beat up, who... She was an eyewitness to four guards beating one of the individuals in a white jumpsuit into a coma. Now, when they beat a prisoner within eyes distance of an ACLU lawyer who is on the premises, and they are so indifferent to her presence there, they don't even try to comport with the law. They do that with an ACLU lawyer right then and there. You can just imagine what it's like when we're not around. You go from that ward, you go to the high-value detainees, borrowing the language from Guantanamo, who indeed do wear orange jumpsuits. They are truly some of the most shocking of cells. They're shorter than this podium. They're 3 feet wide, 5 feet long. Not allowed to enter into their cells because they are supposed to be the most dangerous of the individuals. You can't even see their faces through the mesh, the very dim one bulb in the back. All you see is a silhouette. They don't ever interact with other individuals. They're basically locked up in solitary confinement. You go from there to the disability ward. It's on the third floor of the facility. And in the disability ward, you have individuals with both physical and mental disabilities. And when I was in the disability ward, an older man said, "Come with me, son." I just looked at my colleague and said, "I'll be back, and I'm not. Call somebody." And he wheels over to the end of the room, and he wanted me to push him up the ramp, which was too steep for him to muster the strength in his arms in the wheelchair to go to the urinal, to go to the toilet. This is in the disability ward, where the ramp is of such a high grade that the very own disabled prisoners cannot access the toilets in the facilities. Then you wander through the halls, you see the guys in the green jumpsuits. They're the ones who are let out with better liberty within the jail, often mopping the floors, running errands, transporting materials between different parts of the jail. And as I'm rounding the corner out of the infirmary, I see a fellow in a powder blue jumpsuit. I said, "Okay, dark blue, general ward. Green is greater liberty. White, sex offenders. Orange, high-value detainees. Gray, disabilities, disability ward." So I walk up to him and I say, "Sir, what? Can you tell me what your powder blue jumpsuit means?" He says, "Oh, honey, this is my... I'm a homosexual. I'm part of the homosexual ward. This is my outfit." I said, "Well, how do you feel about that, sir?" He said, "What? You mean my pink triangle? You think you mean my dartboard that is on my back, so that whenever I walk down the hall of the LA County Men's Jail, anyone in the jail knows who the faggots are, and it's open hunting season on us." And it's remarkable that this is done in LA, in the great bastion of progressive liberal politics, with your and my tax dollars. And it's hard to imagine a greater recipe for disaster and for brutalization of a community of people. Jails are meant to be places that house people who are innocent until proven guilty. pre-adjudication. Individuals who might not be able to afford to post bail, but who have not been deemed yet guilty. So they're likely to be thousands of innocent individuals who will ultimately be found innocent of the crimes of which they are charged, who will have been subjected to the brutalization of that experience. Now, how could you imagine that not being a brutal experience when you have so many people crammed into these squalid jails? Violence is inevitable. You have a pervasive culture of savage violence, of prisoner on prisoner, on guard on prisoner, guard on guard even. You have an environment where people's mental illnesses, when they come in, get worse. Where people whose spirits are flagging get broken. And in a culture of brutality, that even if they're lucky enough then to get released, scars them for life, and they carry that scar and that anger and that violence into the communities in which they go back to return. And then what happens once you get out of one of these facilities? Imagine for a moment that you're one of the millions of Americans arrested on a minor drug offense, and that you've managed to survive the brutality of the detention, that by some miracle you're still able and still wish to be a productive member of society. You think it would be easy to redeem yourself. You think the legal system would make it simple for you. But if you read the statistics about recidivism, you ask yourself, why will people commit the same mistake twice? And you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Until you look at how hard it is to actually gain that redemption. Another one of our clients, Jessica Cipione, a New Yorker like me, was busted in 1988 for cocaine possession. She served 7 months in a federal prison in New York. Upon release, her right to vote was automatically restored in New York State, and after her sentence was completed. Then she moved to Florida, where the state has taken the practice of voter suppression to the highest of art forms, and where she was permanently disenfranchised from voting, unless she filed a petition to have her voting rights restored. While in Florida, she decided to go to law school. She applied, got accepted, went to a local law school, matriculated in 2008, learned that upon arriving in law school, that unless she had her voting rights restored, she would not be allowed to take the bar exam, that she needed to restore her voting rights as a prerequisite to entering as a licensed attorney. So as a first-year law student, she said, well, let me get on this. This might take a little bit. She applied in 2008. When she graduated in 2011, 3 years, her application was still pending. Now, in between, a cynical governor had changed the rules. Before, she would have to submit her application. It was rather automatic, time-consuming. The more cynical governor came in, demanded a case-by-case review, even though 99% of all the people whose petitions for their voting rights had been restored ultimately over time. Now, unable to take the bar exam because she didn't have her civil rights restored, and $200,000 in student debt, she was unable to secure a job. She fell into a financial hole out of which she was never able to climb out of. She and her two sons moved in with her dad in federal government-assisted housing. When she finally got her voting rights restored in 2013, she couldn't get a job. People kept asking, well, you went to law school in 2008, you graduated in 2011, what have you been doing since 2011? 2 years? We all know that those first jobs right out of school are some of the most important jobs that get you on the right path for your career. That if you take a 2-year hiatus from your new training as a lawyer and don't have a bar license and have not worked as a lawyer, it's going to be very hard, harder and harder to get a job the further out of school you become. She's never been able to get a job as a lawyer. She's worked as hard as anyone ever has. She is the case of redemption. She did the crime, did the time, came back, put herself on her feet, put herself through law school, graduated, and we never gave her the chance to redeem herself. Now, a young person today in many of our colleges and universities with a single nonviolent felony drug conviction will find themselves forever ineligible for federal student aid. Forever. A parent with a felony conviction will find themselves forever barred from living in federally subsidized housing. Now, how can you possibly have a chance at redemption if you're put out on the street with no money and no prospects, when a released felon can be barred even from living with a family member in federally subsidized housing? How can you find a job when you don't have a closet to hang the clothes for your interview? How can you find a job if you don't have a home or a telephone number where an employer can call you back for that second interview? The way stations for redemption have been closed off to some of the people who need them most in our country. And it is an utter tragedy that has to change. Luckily, it's begun to change in the political climate we now see. We have made criminal justice reform our top organizational priority. We work on all the issues: freedom of speech, church-state separation, women's rights, abortion rights, LGBT rights. First among equals is the need to reform our criminal justice system. We believe that because not just of the magnitude of the problem, but because we think this is a unique opportunity where we can find common ground with individuals who had not been with us before. We're working with individuals who are progressives and liberals. We're also working with some very conservative right-wing leaders. We are finding common ground with the Koch brothers. We are working with Ed Meese. We are working with Grover Norquist for Americans for Tax Reform. Ed Meese, who often despised and often labeled us as the American Criminal Liberties Union, now agrees with us. And I have always to stifle a very kind of strong impulse to smirk when in those meetings. And we find that it's not just some of the elected officials or the conservatives or liberals, but it's also the American people have finally woken up. And basic common sense says, yeah, something's wrong. This doesn't make a lot of sense. When we did a national poll just in June of this year that polled Americans all across the country and looked at both Republicans and Democrats, independents, we found that 81% of Democrats said that reducing the prison population had to be a top priority for our country, that 71% of independents and 54%, a majority of Republicans, said that reducing the prison population had to be a top priority. You find that even in places that are conservative jurisdictions, that there is support for retroactively changing some of these sentencing laws. We enacted and helped push a ballot referendum in California that passed by a margin of 60 to 40%, winning even in places like San Diego and Imperial County and the Central Valley, winning majorities in those communities where you retroactively reclassified a dozen former felonies as misdemeanors. So you took away the stigma of being a convicted felon for nonviolent property crimes and nonviolent drug crimes, and you turned them immediately into misdemeanors. So you never were a felon. With a wave of this ballot initiative's wand, you took a former felon, you just made them someone who had a small misdemeanor. You didn't have to petition for your voting rights restored because you never lost them. We think that that very same approach can be used in other places. We're doing exactly that same type of ballot initiative approach in a place like Oklahoma, where we're working with conservatives in Oklahoma and libertarians to put this question to the Oklahoma public about whether or not to retroactively reclassify former felonies as misdemeanors. Now, I'm not saying that every prisoner should be released or that every person can be redeemed. But I am saying that the United States of America is a great nation because we give people a second chance, because we believe the idea has been embedded in our culture for many more years than just even the short history of even our country. that redemption and forgiveness are essential parts of how many of us were brought up, whether atheists or agnostic or believing, that they were parts of how we view the way we which we interact with each other, that second acts, second chances, are part of the DNA of our country, that many of the immigrants who fled the tyranny of Europe or fled the potato famines or fled economic uncertainties came here seeking a second chance. We are, in fact, not just a nation of immigrants. We are a nation of redeemed emigrants. And so we need to double down on this core value, restore it, resuscitate it in the way that we think about the debate of our laws and policies. President Obama, when he went to go visit with the Oklahoma El Reno Federal Penitentiary, the very first president who ever visited a federal penitentiary, when he came out, he had some very kind of poignant and often off-the-cuff words that he shared. He said, quote, "When they describe their youth and their childhood, these are young people who made mistakes that aren't that different than the mistakes I made and the mistakes that a lot of you guys made. The difference is they didn't have the kind of support structures, the kind of second chances, the resources that would allow them to survive such mistakes." And as a child who grew up in New York City public housing projects, I too know people like the ones that President Obama met at the Oklahoma Penitentiary. I can see it among family members and cousins and kids I went to school with. Good, smart kids who came from very fine families who somehow got off on the wrong foot, made a couple of mistakes, maybe even one or two of them, and found their lives completely in a downward spiral out of which they were never able to be given a second chance. I understand that these mistakes are ones that we have to give ourselves and each other the opportunity to bounce back from them. And I wanted you to hear these stories of the individuals tonight so that when you read these press reports and you hear about these political pundits who are playing tough on crime and your eyes want to glaze over and you just want to mute the channel and say, okay, let's see what's on Antique Roadshow. Right? And, or when you glaze over the idea that, oh, it's just another statistic. It's 2.2 million people. How are we ever going to fix this problem? It's just too big. It's too intractable. It's in the communities. It's not their fault, but the violence is in the communities, and it's just part of surviving in the urban jungle where people make those mistakes. Whenever you begin to think that it's time to get cynical or tune out, I want you to remember the stories of Craig Cecil. Right? Life without parole because he rented a truck to guys who transported marijuana, who'll never see his two daughters. I want you to think the story of Marcus DeSanders, playing very loud music, happened to have a blunt in the ashtray that he forgot about, found himself losing his job, losing his college credit, not able to take his kid to his doctor. I want you to think about Edwina Nolan, if nobody else, right? This poor mother. Trying to get out of a homeless shelter, not able to pay fee upon fee upon fee because her kid made a mistake who was 15 years old and locked up for 60 days because she was too poor to pay those fees. I want you to think about the guy in that blue jumpsuit. Just the kind of the cynicism, the bitterness, the kind of the resignation, the brutality in his interaction with me. You got to think about Jessica, who tried to give it a whirl, who tried to redeem herself and become a lawyer and yet was denied that chance at a second act. And just when you think it's all going to become too hard or too difficult, remember those faces and then take a look at the closest mirror and take a look at your own face and take a look for a moment and say, there before the grace of God could go I. And then remind ourselves and each other that we need to redeem redemption not for their sake but for our very own, if for nothing else. Thank you very much. I'll be glad to take your questions.